I'll ask missionaries, you know, have they ever passed a night, a sleepless night, praying, burdened over the souls of men in the particular area where they feel called to minister? And oftentimes I get the answer, well, yes. Yes, we have. I say, well, that's wonderful, that's necessary, and that's good. But then I ask them another question. Have you ever passed a sleepless night in prayer because in that place God was not worshipped as He ought to be worshipped? That the zeal for God's honor and glory kept you up all night? And most say, well, I've never really thought about that. And you see, that right there shows us a problem. Shows us a tremendous problem. Missions, by and large, has become something quite humanistic. There's a sermon out there called 10 Shekels in a Shirt. It's one of my favorites that a man has preached. And he talked about his wrong view of missions. He would have never said this, he said, when he first went to Africa, but he said basically what he was doing was thinking that he had to go to Africa to save a bunch of people from a judging, angry God. When he got to Africa, he discovered that people already knew more about God than most people know in the United States. They just didn't want him. One of the points he was trying to make is we do not go to the mission field primarily for men. We go to the mission field for God. We go to mission field for the glory of God. You know, romantic love will only take you so far, because romantic love requires a response from the object of your love. For example, if you go down to the mission field and you begin to preach, and 10,000 people are converted and they lift you up on their shoulders and the hallelujah chorus breaks out and churches are planted all over, well, I suppose that's a great motivation, but it usually doesn't happen that way. On the mission field, a lot of times you'll walk into the plaza or the square and set up your little pulpit and begin to preach and hand out Bibles, and someone will start screaming that you're a demon, and they'll grab you and your Bibles and everything else and throw you out on the street. It takes a lot more than romantic love for men for you to get back up, go to the pulpit and preach again. Continue handing out tracts to people who hate you. You have to do it primarily because of the zeal you have for the glory of God. We ought to be disturbed that men are lost. We ought to be disturbed that there are places where the gospel is not preached. But that should not be our primary concern. Our primary concern should be this. There are places on this earth that belong to Jesus Christ where Jesus Christ is not worshipped. It's for Him we go. For Him. Never forget, there are two great commands. You shall love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you shall love thy neighbor as yourself. Don't get those backwards. Not even on the mission field. You go primarily not out of a love for men. You go primarily out of a love for God. And since God is a constant in that covenant, and He will never fail thee, nor give you reason to doubt Him, it is much easier to do things for the glory of God than it is for the love of men. For the love of men. We live in a society that is success-based. Everything is determined by apparent success. I want you to realize that that will be terribly turned around on the day of judgment. It will be shown as what it is, worthless fodder. So much that on this side of heaven looks like a success and it's not. So much looks like a failure and it's not. We go, we minister, we preach, we do missions, we are pastors, we are deacons, we are Christians, we are churchmen, we are everything that we are, not in order to be a success or to have some result come about. We do it for the glory of God and the simple sake of being faithful, because He's worthy of faithfulness. One of my favorite passages, and it's kind of a passage that has so much importance for our mission, it is For from the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations, and in every place incense is going to be burned to my name, and a grain offering that is pure, for my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. Now, I think it's quite interesting. This is found in the book of Malachi, a book that is not very promising as far as people go. A book in which, as I heard one old preacher say one time, God was quite angry. And you can tell He was angry because after the book of Malachi, He didn't speak to anyone for 400 years. Now, in this book, what do we see? We see the nation of Israel. They could basically care less about the Gentiles. Not only were they unconcerned about anyone who was not a Jew, they took sort of what we would say the opinion of Jonah and would just be just as happy as if every Gentile and person of another nation perished. Now, we shouldn't judge the Jews in this. They had been persecuted widely and greatly by many, many peoples. They were concerned for themselves. They were not concerned for the nations. But also they were not concerned for the glory of God. In the first chapter of Malachi, you can see that to them, the religious ritual of the Old Covenant was a burden. It made them tired. They had no desire to serve the Lord. They had no desire to worship Him. They had no desire to see His promotion or the promotion of His glory. They could care less for God, and they could care less, much less, for the Gentile peoples. But in the midst of all this, God says, I will make my name great among the nations. I will do it. Many times in mission endeavors and mission conferences, we hear mission leaders get up and almost whine. And they portray God as this impotent deity who's wringing His hands while He sits on the throne. And they say things like this: if you don't go, no one will tell them. If you don't go, no one will reach them. If you don't do this, the entire enterprise of the Great Commission will fall apart. That is not true. Here we see a nation that would not go, did not care. Not only would they not go, they wouldn't even do the temple services themselves. But yet in the midst of all the disobedience of men, God says, I will make my name great among the nations from the rising to the setting of the sun. God has called us to be a part of the Great Commission. That is true. But I want to tell you something. Whether you obey or not, God is going to make His name great among the nations. He will. God does not call us to minister with Him in this Great Commission because He has a need. He calls us so as to invite us into a privilege, that our life would mean something, that we would have a purpose, a great purpose of promoting His glory. That's what missions is about. It's about a desire in your heart for God's name to be glorified, to be magnified among the nations. And in that, of course, is the second commandment, your desire to see people come to know the Savior. To see lives restored, to see families restored, to see societies restored. You say, oh, Brother Paul, societies restored? You are living in a country, no matter how godless it has become, all the benefits and all the blessings and everything that is still right about this country comes from the fact that God restored a society through the gospel. And you need to understand that. It's like this morning when I talked about Harry Potter. It is a denial of the gospel, but in order to make their witches appealing, they must borrow Christian virtue. They build upon the Christian foundation the very foundation that they hate. And that's the way our country is. It's trying to tear down the very foundation that has caused all its prosperity. And so we need to see that God has revolutionized and changed societies, not just individuals, not just families, but societies with the gospel. And that ought to be our goal. It ought to be our goal for God to raise up peoples and show in the raising up of peoples His power and His glory. Now, heart cry has kind of just to me is kind of an unexplainable thing, a work of grace on God's part. In 1988, of course, I went to Peru after seminary, not with a mission organization. I just felt like God wanted me to go under the authority of just a local church. And began to work there, and God began to prosper and bless and work in my life, teaching me things. I graduated from somewhat of a neo-Orthodox seminary that did not have very good theology. And it was in South America, just reading the scriptures over and over, that I came to believe many of the things that I believe now. But while I was there, we planted a church and then began to plant some satellite churches in the slums of southern Lima. In doing that, I came into contact with men, very impoverished, many uneducated and uneducated theologically, but who were able to plant churches better than I could. And I began to think about some things. You know, to plant one good biblical church, if that can be done by a man or a team of men in 10 years, it's an absolute miracle. Churches that rise up within a year or two and grow to be very large usually fall in about the same time. But to plant a biblical church requires a decade of very, very hard work. And if a man had 40 years of ministry, he could maybe plant four churches, and that would be an amazing thing. But I began to see all these men who had been called to plant churches, but they did not have the training. They did not have the theology. They had no guidance. And they were very, very poor. Many of them would work 14, 15 hours a day at a job that would just barely buy food for their children and then try to go out and minister. And so I began to think about some things, about instead of sending a North American missionary that may require $3,000 a month support, why not support some of these men and not only support them but train them and raise up a missionary force from them? And then after about a year and a half, I met a man by the name of Angel Colmenares in the north of Peru, who God had used at that time to start nearly 100 churches. And now that number has grown to probably 600 churches. And I began to see how God was using this pitiful man, pitiful, impoverished, poor man, and began to, I'd go up and work with him, teach some of the men. You have to understand something. We say something. Now, if you're not Baptist, that's okay. I know that we've got our own problems, but there's a statement that we make in Peru among the Baptists, and it's usually with regard to the Pentecostals and others, and it's this: the Baptists evangelize the lost, and everybody else evangelizes the Baptist. And what we mean by that is when we'd start a church somewhere, and the Presbyterians and others say the same thing, is when a pretty sound evangelical group starts planting a church, you can pretty much count on the fact that that all the cults and marginal Christian groups are going to come and try to steal your people. It just happens all the time. Whenever a move of God breaks out where there's sound theology, then every kind of fringe group, Christian group that you can imagine comes in and starts trying to take away the sheep. And so what God used me to provide some of the theological training and just to protect the men. We have problem with Seventh-day Adventist in Peru. We have a great problem with the Jesus-only people, which are, who's the fella, T.D. Jakes, for example, where they deny the Trinity. And things like that. And so constant battles with United Pentecostal, constant battles with Seventh-day Adventist, constant battles with Jehovah Witnesses, and then every number of fringe groups. And so I began to see something. There were men out there who lived on $50 a month, who could start churches better than any North American missionary, and yet they needed help. They needed financial help and they needed training. And so we began on a small way to I just prayed and prayed with my wife, and whatever we received, we just started begin supporting some men and training them. And I decided that I'd always been been greatly blessed by George Mueller, always. And I realized that if we were going to start something in which we were going to support missionaries in this fashion, that I wasn't strong enough to make it go. I'm not a salesperson. I'm not a mover and a shaker. I'm just not. And so I just said, Lord, if this is from you, then you're going to have to support the whole thing. We're not going to raise funds. We're not going to raise support. We're not going to visit churches and ask for money. The only thing that we will do is we'll just publish a magazine, a small, and it was at first 4 pages on a photocopy machine. We'll publish a magazine, but we will not ask people for money in the magazine, ever. We will not say, these are our needs, pray about it. We'll just tell people what we're doing. And if we do speak in a church, it'll only be because we've been invited. And if we do speak in a church, we will not tell them our needs, nor will we raise funds. And God began to bless. And He had, over the last 10 years, it's just been phenomenal. I remember I was talking to my wife the other day, and I said, honey, do you remember when I couldn't sleep at night because I knew that we needed $150 a month to support missionaries. That we were supporting $150 worth of missionaries, and how some nights I would just wonder, would God provide the money? And Dr. Barry, who works with us now at HeartCry, came to me and he goes, Paul, he goes, as of September, we will be sending out $43,000 a month just to missionaries. Not to buildings and Bibles and all the other things that we do, but just supporting indigenous missionaries. And that is a result of the faithfulness of God. Jim Elliff, I don't know who it is, but he says a friend of his is fond of saying, God delights in vindicating the confidence of His children. God delights in vindicating the confidence of His children. When we set to shut ourselves up to just the mercies of God, then God will do a work, because He will prove that He can be counted on. I remember, it was probably 3 years into this, I was back in the States, and God had prospered us a bit. We had a few missionaries in Peru, and there were two other missionary organizations, and they wanted to meet with me in Nashville. I'll never forget this. And so I got in my truck and drove down to Nashville. And the other two missionary guys flew in on a plane, and then the other guy flew in on a private plane that the mission used. And they all wanted to know what our fundraising techniques were. And I said, gentlemen, I am so sorry that we have, you've flown in and your planes and everything we don't have any. And said, well, you must have something. No, sir, we don't have anything. How do you keep it going? It was never my intention to keep it going. You see, some ministries ought to die. Don't you realize that? Some ministries ought to die, and not because they're bad. Some run their course. Maybe HeartCry one day will run its course, and the worst thing you can do is try to keep it alive if God wants it dead. You see, if you start something, you've got to keep it going. If you've got to keep it going, you're a miserable human being. But if it just belongs to God, then it just belongs to God. And so God, I can't tell you how many times over the years that God would just do spectacular, miraculous things. Never one time in the history of HeartCry has a foreign missionary missed his support. Not one time. Now, those who work on staff with HeartCry, they have to come with an agreement that they are not paid until the missionaries are. And if they have to give up their salaries, they have to give up their salaries so that the missionaries can stay on the field. And I can tell you this, there have been several times when for weeks the staff has not been paid. But here's the amazing thing. Every time without failure, when the staff has not been paid, God supplied the needs of every one of the staff members, and it amounted to more than if they had received their check. He is the most marvelous God. He is the most marvelous God. And He delights in vindicating the confidence of His children. He delights in it. And now, a lot of times when people will hear this, they think, oh my goodness, you know, faith, faith. I saw a sign out here the other day when we were driving in yesterday, and I just had to laugh. It says, when our faith works, God works. That's the most pathetic piece of dribble I've ever read in my life. It's not true. If God worked according to Paul Washer's faith, I'd be dead. Don't you realize that God gives faith? And it's not the size of your faith. It is the object of your faith. Dear man Charles Leiter shared with me one time, we were talking about faith, and he said, Paul, he goes, look at it this way. Let's say there is a courageous, bold, strong man, and he's walking down a lane with a weak, frightened man who's afraid of his shadow. And they come to a bridge that's really rickety. They have to pass over this terrible, terrible abyss. And they come to a bridge. And the frightened little weak, narrow-chested man, he looks at it and falls down weeping and says, I'm lost. I can never make it across that bridge. But the strong, bold, hardy man who's afraid of nothing says, I'll make it across. And he steps out on that bridge, makes it halfway across. The bridge is a rickety, terrible thing, and it breaks and falls through, and he's destroyed. And he said, the weak man is now even more disheartened, more frightened, and he keeps going until finally he comes to a bridge that's overkill. This bridge is made out of 400 times the cement and steel that it needs to be made out of. It's so wide a semi could go across it without fear. And that frightened man stands there for hours debating and weeping of whether or not he should cross it. It's absolutely absurd. Of course he should cross it. There's nothing to be afraid of, but he's afraid. Finally, he gets down on his hands and knees. And then he gets down on his face, lays his chest to the ground, and weeping and terrified, he crawls across the bridge. But he makes it across the bridge. It's not the size of our faith. It's the strength of our God. And you know, what people don't realize about faith, faith is not without doubt. As a matter of fact, most of the time men will believe God with fear and trembling to show that it is God and His faithfulness and not the faith of men. Not the faith of men. You know, it seems to me that every time God does something, even among God's people, Satan works to somehow wrangle that thing around so that people are somehow given the credit for what God's done. And it is blasphemous. And if you know anything about God, you also know it's foolish and stupid and wicked. Let me share when God truly, truly does something. Let me share with you what really happens. The attitude that we should have when God does something in our lives or through us. Jesus tells Peter, even though he's full of doubt, to cast a net. Peter casts the net, and the net fills up with fish. We all know that. They're pulling in great quantities of fish, and Peter turns around and looks at Jesus. And he falls to the ground, and what does he say? Depart from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man. Whenever we see God do something through us, that, in a sense, should be our attitude. Peter is saying, Lord, I am not worthy. I should not be here. This miracle should not have been done around me. I am a sinful man. And I can just see Peter just laying probably over on his hip with one hand on the boat like this on the floor and kind of leaning back and crawling away from the Lord saying, "Depart from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man." Just a terrible crisis, wanting to hide, thinking it's almost wrong that he should have been allowed to see this. That's the way, in a sense, when we see God move, that's the way our attitude should be. Lord, anyone on earth, anyone other than me should have been able to see this. Lord, depart from me. I'm a sinful man. It's almost wrong that you would use someone like me. And if someone were at that moment to walk up to you and even suggest that you had something to do with God using you, you would want to vomit. You would say, "Get away from me. Get thee behind me, Satan." Because you're just so convinced that it is the Lord. I also find it interesting in that story, most people, "Come on in." Most people don't realize that story is telling us that Jesus is God. And you say, "Well, of course it is. He had control over nature." Yes, Jesus is God. No, you're missing the point. Now just look at what happens. The Son of God, at that moment, by telling him to cast the net and pull out the fish, look what's going on. He demonstrates his glory. He reveals his glory. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above him stood the seraph, each one having six wings. With two they covered their face, with two they covered their feet, and with two they did fly. And one cried unto the other, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him and cried. And then said I, 'Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.'" What does John chapter 12 tell us about this? It tells us that Isaiah saw the Son of God. That passage in Isaiah 6 was the Son of God. The Father has always done everything He has done through His Son. He created the world through His Son. He revealed Himself to the world through His Son. He saved the world through His Son, and He will judge the world through His Son. Isaiah saw the Son. So there in Isaiah 6, what happens? The Son of God reveals His glory to Isaiah. What happened there with Peter? The Son of God revealed His glory to Peter. What happened to Isaiah? When Isaiah saw that, Isaiah cried out, "Oh no, I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips." When Peter saw the glory of the Son revealed in Jesus Christ that day on that boat, he said, "Depart from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." Isaiah, after he is broken, he is commissioned. "Who will go for us?" And Isaiah said, "Here I am." After Peter was broken, said, "Depart from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man." He said, "I will make you fisher of men." It's an amazing thing, this Lord of ours. An amazing thing. And what is so very important here is what you know about God. What you know about God. With my children, let me give you an example. I put my little boys, when they could just barely stand, I put them up on the counter on the kitchen. And I make them stand up there. And then I get back and I say, I'm touching them with my hands, and I say, "Jump." If they don't jump, I'll swat them on the hind end. You think I'm terrible, I know, but let me keep going. And I'll say, "Jump." And they jump. Then I stand back a little farther where it gets a little more dangerous. And a little bit farther where it gets a little more dangerous, but I always catch them. Now you say, one guy asked me, he says, "Are you trying to teach your children to be courageous?" I said, "No, I'm teaching them faith." "What do you mean?" I'm teaching them that they can trust the word of their father. If their father says jump, they can jump. I'm teaching them to trust, and I'm also teaching them that a lack of trust is disobedience. You see, it is not about courage. It's about believing your God. It's about believing your God. It's not about being fearless. It's about believing your God. Are you afraid? Yes, I am absolutely terrified. Then why are you doing it? He can be believed. He can be believed. And to not believe Him is to very make an attack on His character. To denounce Him and say He's not the God He claims to be. So see, it's not about the size of our faith. It's not about our courage. It's about knowing who He is. He is worthy to be trusted, to be believed. He is. I don't need to have courageous sons. I only need to have sons that in their weakness believe God. Believe God. You see. And another thing that is so very, very important. Have you ever seen this? It's a pretty poem where it footprints in the sand, where, you know, the guy's walking along and he notices that in all the good times of his life, you know, there's two sets of footprints, and he looks down and it's like Jesus is walking beside him. But he looks in the clouds, and in the bad times of his life, there's only one set of footprints. And he goes to the Lord and says, "How is it that you could leave me on the times when things were so bad?" And the Lord says, "Oh, my child, you know, I didn't leave you. It was at that time I carried you." That is the worst piece of dribble. And if you've got it, take it off your wall. "It was at that time I carried..." He's always carried you. He's had to carry you through the good times. He's had to carry you through the bad times. He's had to carry you always. It's always just been one set of footprints in the sand. And they're His. You actually think in the good times you're strong enough to walk independently? What did He tell Israel? "I carried you on eagle's wings. I carried you on eagle's wings." The one thing that I have seen, if you will just keep doing what you're called to do, if you'll just keep doing what you're called to do, whether it be here or there, what it will be like is this. It'll be like a man who throws seed out his window and then forgets about the seed. And then one day looks out the window and a mature plant has grown with fruit on it. And he'll say, "Where did this come from?" You see, we have just the opposite. Well, what was your strategy? What did you do? And how did you work this out? I remember one time going to a conference in Peru. I didn't stay very long. I think I stayed just a few minutes, walked out the door, went home, did something important like play with my dog. But I was at this conference, and this preacher from Houston, Texas gets up and he goes, "First thing I want you to know is I'm a mover and a shaker. I believe in getting things done. Leadership." And I was like, "I'm out of here. I don't believe any of that. Do I believe in biblical leadership? Yes. Do I believe that there are certain character traits that we need to seek to have for leaders of churches or leaders of businesses or leaders? Yes, of course I do." But his whole attitude showed that probably most of what he's built in his own name and in his own power. You know, it's like a Chinese Christian came to the United States, and after seeing everything he saw about our churches, you know what he said? "I'm amazed at all that you people can accomplish without God. All you're able to do without God." I tell some of my friends, if God uses you, if you think God's used you and you can write a book about it, it wasn't God. If you can sit down and write out a book of why all this happened the way it did, it probably wasn't God. If it is God, it'd probably be a very short book. It'd be you saying, "Well, I was standing here and God came from that direction, went that way and left a whole bunch of fruit in His path. That's about all I can tell you. It's about all I can tell you." Now, getting back to Heart Cry, one of the things that We've made some changes in the last year or so. And I think part of it is a theological maturity, I hope, I believe. And it is this. Although we hadn't really said it, we had kind of adopted, because of me, this idea, well, you know, there's no church there. So if we plant a church there, even though it's not exactly the kind of church that we would want to attend with our family, theologically maybe it's not quite up to par, it's still better to have a church there than to have no church at all. And we've really, like I said, we would have never expressed it that way, but that's what a few years ago I began to see. That's not what God's called us to do. God's called us to plant churches around the world that we would want to attend with our own families. And if it means not growing as quickly, if it means not being able to do a whole bunch of things, fine. But our great conviction is not simply planting sort of, you know, sound, normal evangelical churches, but to plant churches, evangelical churches, that are the type of churches we would want to attend. Which means, if an area opens up, but we still are swamped by training men that we presently have and preparing them for the ministry, we just can't do it. We want to give ourselves more and more, as the years go by, to theological training and to preparing men. We work in two different sorts of areas, and some of my Reformed friends can't understand this, and some just absolutely love it because I think they sense what we're doing. Let me give you an example. There are some areas where we work where theologically it's like we're like this. I'll give you an example, Zambia, with Conrad Mbewe and Ronald Kalfungwe and all those men. Theologically, we're just like this. As a matter of fact, even the Banner of Truth people write about that movement in Zambia and say it's probably one of the best mission movements in the world. That's not because it came out of us. It's a Zambian work. We just help it. So we have certain areas in the world where theologically and everything else, I would say that there's just perfect affinity and unity. But there are other places around the world that through the years they've asked us to come and help. These are pastors who never heard truths, some of the greatest truths that we hold dear. They've never heard them. But the door has opened up for us to go there. And so we go there. Let me give you an example. Romania. In Romania, when we got there, almost everybody among the Baptist, even among the Presbyterian, believed you could lose your salvation. Now, we won't work with anybody who believes that. We simply will not. But it's not enough just to get someone to say you won't lose your salvation. So we began, over the last 10 years, we've been training men. It started out kind of rough. It was difficult to go in there with a completely different view of evangelism, a completely different view of how men get saved, a completely different view of perseverance of the saints, and all these different things. But over the years, by working with men that theologically were different, there are countless men now who accept the Reformed truth. And so we're willing to go into areas where men have never heard of the great Reformed teachers. They've never had the opportunity. All they've ever known was easy believism and all the things that we so despise. But going in there, their lives have been changed. And so in Eastern Europe, there's a reform movement going on. And it's because of our willingness to work with people who just aren't there yet. Same way in Peru. God is raising up a whole generation of new preachers and young guys who are reading the old stuff. They're reading Spurgeon. They're reading Calvin. They're reading all these men. They're beginning to see that most of their evangelism and their way of looking at missions and everything else is just based on superficial Americanisms. And so we have two different sorts of ministries, and we're very, very happy about that. When God opens up a door for us to train and teach, we will go. I myself personally, for example, I have been invited to so many different types of things, you would not believe it. A few years ago, there was a rumor going around that I was charismatic. Now, that's about as... That I was charismatic. And the reason why is because a charismatic pastor asked me to come and teach in his church because he was beginning to see a bunch of the truths that we were sharing. So I went and I taught. And God began to just transform his life. You see, what we need to understand is sometimes we'll say, you know, I asked these missionaries who said these things about me. I said this. I said, let me ask you a question. If there was a wife-beating murderer who lived across the street, and I went across the street to witness to him, what would you think about me? Well, you're doing the work of an evangelist. Praise God. You love souls. Okay. Well, here's a man over here across the block who has suffered for the sake of Christ, who serves Christ, has counted the cost of discipleship, but because he's never had the education, he's never had the books, he's never been exposed to sound historical teaching, I'm to leave him alone and to avoid him like the plague? No. There are so many places outside this country right now where people are just screaming. They're just wanting truth. The internet, although it's done a whole lot of damage around the world, it's done a whole lot of good. To see Peruvian pastors in the mountains who are able to download Charles Spurgeon or Calvin or Hodge or just on and on. It's just amazing. And it's bringing about something of a reformation. And at Heartcry, what we want to do is we want to capitalize on that. And we send teams around the world to teach. And our primary areas of teaching are this: soteriology, the doctrine of salvation, expository preaching, ideas which of sanctification, of true sanctification as a process of growing in godliness, as God beginning a work and finishing it, and us working out our salvation in fear and trembling. And so that's what, as the years go by, we seem to be more and more involved in not just planting churches, but really working at teaching truth. Also, I work like right now, between these two preachings, I was back in the hotel after lunch and I was working on a thing on the hatred of God, a biblical view of the hatred of God. I finished it in English. I will start probably tomorrow while I'm on the plane translating it into Spanish. So all these different things is what we're doing to bring out truth. And one of the things that we've done is we've got a little saying there at the mission that missions is not about sending missionaries. Missions is about sending truth through missionaries. Because you can send out all the missionaries in the world, but if they don't have truth, you're doing nothing but adding to the problem. Let me just give you a short example and I'll stop. And it's this. You all know that Fidel Castro is probably on his way to death. I mean, he's not going to live much longer. That terrifies me, that he's going to die. And I'll tell you why. When Fidel Castro dies, the wall's probably going to fall. And you say, what's bad about that? North American missionaries will enter into Cuba. That's what terrifies me. Every kind of heresy, superficial, stupid, unbiblical doctrine that's driving this country into the ground is going to be pumped into Cuba. And it's going to do exactly what it's done in many churches around the world. It's going to ruin them. I remember when the wall fell in Eastern Europe, going into Romania. I preached an expository message at the Holy Trinity Church in Bucharest. And all the pastors that were up there and the thing began to weep. And they said, we used to preach like that before the wall fell and we learned all about the American strategies for building churches. One of the leaders came up to me and said, you know, Brother Paul, if what all the North American evangelists say is true about how many people have been saved under their ministry in Romania, then everyone in my country has been saved four times. There have been good missionaries that have come out of this country, but I want you to know, this country has also belched out more heresy than just about any place on the face of the earth. And so it's not just about sending missionaries. Another thing you need to understand, I was talking to a fine reformed gentleman who's working in China with his wife, and all he's doing is teaching pastors. And he told me, he said, "Brother Paul, I've tried to do the best I can a statistical research on how much of all mission giving actually goes to truth, to the proclamation of truth, a concern for sound doctrine." And he said, "From what I have gathered over the years, my estimation would be somewhere between 2% and 4% of all the money given to missions actually goes to the proclamation of truth and teaching truth and sound doctrine among churches around the world." You can go and see that there are hundreds of missionary families in certain countries and only find a handful of them that are actually church planters that actually deal with preaching. Again, missions is not about sending missionaries. It's about sending truth through missionaries. All right. Is it time to go, I guess? 6 o'clock?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, brother.